This episode of Nothing to Fear contains discussion of themes related to sexual assault. If you believe this material would be too confronting for you, please join us for our next episode.
I hope that in Train to Busan, my favourite moment was improvised, but we'll talk about that.
It would have required a lot of people to simultaneously improvise. Hey guys, what do you reckon when they call action? Let's just all run through the train and like fucking pile up. It'll be sick.
It was meant to be a romance movie and then it turned into a zombie movie and it was all improvised.
Hang on. This idea is sick. Let's just go with, what if it's just an undead thing? Like, fuck this father-daughter shit. Let's just get them chased all the time.
Eliza, what did you watch today that was not horror-related or that was horror-related?
Movies? I haven't watched a movie in a while.
No, just like goings on in the street. What do you think the podcast is about? Fear of freaking out. Hashtag nomofofo. Is it good or is it shit? You guys look
maybe
like it's shit.
We should laugh.
It's you didn't good giggle?
It's good if you
Yeah, do you
want
to do it again and I'll giggle?
I'm not going to force a giggle.
I'll force a giggle.
All right. You
It'll
can
be
force
so
a giggle.
Real.
How about we just don't force the hashtag and I just delete
it? No, do it again. Do it again. Just do it again.
Just believe
just
in
try
yourself,
it.
Dave.
We'll just try it. Just do it.
Welcome back, dear friend, to Nothing to Fear, the podcast designed to rid you of your fear of freaking out. Hashtag nomofofo.
That's a good one. It's
great. That's trending. That's going to take off.
Scripted reactions. So genuine.
I forgot that I had to do it, and then I didn't do a very good job.
Thank you, Joe.
Just sell it, Dave.
I'm pretty sure the script said, don't point out that this is a scripted reaction.
The McElroys don't always laugh at Griffin's jokes, but they're always
true.
Hilarious.
That's true.
Why is that always our reference
because
point?
Because it's a thing that Dave and I can bond over.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
That's fine.
Because we have, you know, little else.
You can have that one.
I am your host, David Malloy.
I'm Joe Paro.
I'm Eliza Sykes. Sorry.
Podcast wizard Eliza Sykes.
Yes. That's me.
And we are going to discuss some things that we've seen lately, as well as wrapping up our undead thread. And the film that we're reviewing is a little bit behind the times this week. We've kind of been caught up with a bunch of life events over the last 3 weeks, so thank you for bearing with us. I say that, you won't actually have to bear with us because these will be released week after week, because we're trying to be professionals about it this time. But point being, hopefully by the time this episode comes out, you will be able to catch this little flick on Blu-ray or DVD, and it is Stephen King's It.
When you're a kid, you think the universe revolves around you. You think that you'll always be protected and cared for. Then, one day, you realize that's not true. Because when you're alone as a kid, the monsters see you as weaker. You don't even know they're getting closer. Until it's too late.
Thinks this town is cursed. That all the bad things that happen in this town are because of one thing. An evil thing.
In the small town of Derry, Maine, a 7-year-old boy is dragged into the sewers by a creature calling itself Pennywise the Dancing Clown. A year after his disappearance, his brother Bill and 6 of his friends find themselves under assault by the same shape-shifting terror, and with no other options, take it upon themselves to fight back. This is the second adaptation, I think, of Stephen King's It, which was famously adapted into a TV miniseries with Tim Curry playing Pennywise the Dancing Clown. This time around, Pennywise is played by an actor who I believe doesn't have a great deal of credits to his name so far, but he's just sort of a young, cute man who has turned in the just most terrifying iteration of Pennywise that has yet appeared on screen. So, going to cut to you first, Eliza. Your thoughts on It?
I did not enjoy it.
Surprise, surprise. What did you not enjoy about it?
Why is that surprising, by the way? Is it because I just hate everything?
I'm pretty sure that at the end of the movie, Joe and I actually turned to each other and said, Eliza's going to hate this.
I don't know if it was the film or if it was the fact that the people in the cinema annoyed me, but everyone found it much funnier than I did. I did not think it was that funny, and everyone was laughing so much. So much laughing.
I didn't get a lot of laughter in my cinema. A lot of cringing. A lot of squirming, but not heaps of laughter.
I'll make you a bullet point list of the things I didn't like about it. Just a quick little summary. Are you ready?
Before you say it, I will just say that, like, I was probably the laugher in my cinema. It was pretty empty when I saw it. I found it funny. I don't know if a lot of people did.
One, I didn't think it was that funny. Two, I didn't think it was that scary. Three, it was the same thing over and over again, and I thought that it lost its scare factor because the scares were pretty much the same over and over again. Four, it was too long. Five, I've got so many points. Five, the banter between the kids just made them seem like real naughty actors, that like the people just let them get away with anything and they got little laughs, and so then they just kept going and all the adults around them were like, oh, this is so funny, keep going. And so then these kids get little ego boosts and then they don't stop. Like, I'll stop there though.
How long is your list?
No, that's pretty much it. Oh, okay, I mean, cool. There were things that were okay about it. It looked pretty. That's it.
So there was one thing that was good about it.
It just didn't stand out as anything that I would watch again or recommend to people to watch, because one, they've probably already seen it, and two, it just didn't do anything for me.
Sure.
As a person.
Right. Okay. Joe, your hot take.
I really liked it. I had heaps of fun. I thought it brought back memories of reading Goosebumps books. It maintained a really difficult balance between actual stakes and tragedy, like the death of Georgie and, you know, little kids going missing and the family grieving for them is a really sad real life thing. But it also managed to maintain this fantastical sense of horror and the supernatural. And I haven't seen The Goonies, but I think that's the reference that everybody's making for this teen adventure group of American kids kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I thought it was heaps of fun. I know what you mean about it did the same thing over and over again, Eliza, but for me that was just kind of what it was. And I saw it with my partner Jenny, as I mentioned, who doesn't watch horror films. She's a bit like Dave's partner, Pam.
Yeah.
But somehow she let me convince her to come and watch this one. And halfway through it, or even like a third of the way through it, she turned and said, "This is the scariest film I've seen in my life."
Oh, no.
And so the whole time I was super aware of her having the worst time in the cinema. And so I took that on board. And for me, it actually became really freaky because I was kind of seeing it through her eyes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the flute creature in particular freaked the shit out of me.
The flute creature.
Which was the flute creature?
You know when, I can't remember which character it is, he's the Jewish boy and he goes
Jewish
up into
boy.
The room. Yeah, and there's that twisted creature playing the flute in the picture.
It was a painting.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the bit that was not in the book that was actually added to the film.
Okay. That's a good point, actually, Joe. Are you familiar with the book?
No, I'm not. I've only read one Stephen King book and it was not one of his horror books. It was Hearts in Atlantis, which is a fantastic book.
Yeah, right. We were having this conversation the other day. I've read Dreamcatcher and The Stand, and I've seen this and Carrie and The Mist and Shawshank Redemption, and I think that's it. I think that's my familiarity with Stephen King.
What about Misery?
I haven't seen Misery.
Oh, you should watch Misery.
I know. It's great. High on my list. Pam has seen that, and I haven't.
It's really good.
Yeah, so
it's much better than it.
And your familiarity with Stephen King? No.
Nice. I haven't read any Stephen King, but I've seen a few films.
Yeah, that's fair.
Is The Shining Stephen King?
Yeah, it is. Which I think, actually, come to think of it, The Shining speaks to sort of what I really like about Stephen King, I think, which is that when his protagonists are faced by the inexplicable, I think that's when he's at his most interesting. I think that's the strength behind The Mist as well, is not just the threat of the inexplicable, but the threat of people's reactions when they are afraid and when they feel trapped. I think the greatest horror that Stephen King produces doesn't come from the monsters that he crafts, but more the responses to those things that he writes within his human characters. And that's one of the things that I think is pretty strong about It as well, because It is not necessarily reliant on Pennywise as it is reliant on us understanding the manipulation of these characters' innermost fears. And I think that's an interesting approach. Like, it's, I saw your face in Eliza. Like, I know that it's not, like, I know it's potentially not the most original concept, but I think it's executed well here. And it's probably worth mentioning that this film has been in development limbo for about 7 years now. This was supposed to come out a long time ago and had a different director attached to it. They then got Cary Fukunaga, who most people would know as the director of season one of True Detective, but is also the writer-director behind Beasts of No Nation on Netflix, which if you haven't seen it, fucking see it. Oh my God, it's an incredible film. They got him involved with it, but the film that he wanted to make, which I imagine would have been distinctly harsher than this one, was not in line with what the studio wanted for the film, and so Fukunaga moved on. But he's still credited here as a screenwriter, so I'm assuming that at least some of Fukunaga's input remains in the film. And my first impression particularly would be that the opening scene with Georgie feels very Fukunaga to me, because it holds no bars. And that scene, I think, is what really got me into the headspace for this film, is that you did not simply see a child go missing. You saw a child's arm graphically ripped off. And that, I found that very shocking for a movie that I'd come into expecting that more teen adventure tone that you were talking about, Joe. That I think The Goonies is probably a better reference point, but I now associate it with that sort of nostalgia that Stranger Things does so well. Stranger Things, particularly, like, one of my favorite things about the casting was that one of the kids from Stranger Things was in it, and I immediately had that notion of, oh, great, here we go. This poor kid's just going to get typecast.
Finn Wolfhard.
Yeah, and is going to, like, you know, be in this role for the rest of his teenage years. Yeah. But instead, they cast him as the rancorous, horny 13-year-old, and he was just great. Like, he was such a shitty young boy, and I just thought he was so tone perfect.
Can I read you a bit from his IMDb profile, which I think is awesome?
Hit it.
Outside of acting, Finn loves shredding the bass and guitar. During the moments Finn is not on set, in school, memorizing lines or jamming with friends, he spends his time hanging out with his awesome family and pets.
Cute. Did he write that himself?
I have a feeling that his family had a hand in it.
Well, I don't think so. That sounds like an agent to me. That sounds like, look at how cool this kid is. He is a cool young kid. Hire him
but
for
I
your
like
film.
That. He's also in year 8.
What the fuck?
Oh. Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
Fuck
he
that
does
kid.
Look like he's 7.
Does he? I thought he was... would be a bit older.
Get in the bin, Finn.
Jesus. I think he did a great job. I do understand what you mean, Eliza. Sometimes it was a bit like, oh, they've given this kid who was really good in Stranger Things a free rein and he's clearly loving every second. But I was happy to go along on the ride with him because I like him.
That nostalgic thing that you were saying, Dave, I had a conversation with someone yesterday about this, and that was one of the things I was trying to say to her, what did you like about it? And she was like, I just liked it. I don't like to analyze things. And I was like, no, tell me. And so then I finally got it out of her, and she was like, I like the nostalgic feel, you know, like Stranger Things. I think that is an odd impulse, especially for people my age, where these films are kind of set 80s, 90s, and they're a childhood that we never had. Mm. Like, they're not really nostalgic for us.
But the media that we grew up with taught us that world, not necessarily the real world, but like when I said Goosebumps, that's the nostalgia for me. Watching the film felt like I was reading a Goosebumps book, which is what I grew up reading.
Yeah, I guess
and they
so.
Were written by an author who did live in those earlier times.
Yeah, that's where I sit with it as well. And I think a lot of like the young adult kind of films that I watched when I was that age had that similar sort of tone. I mean, I even think of E.T., as having that sort of, like, E.T.'s a much friendlier movie, obviously, but, you know, it still has that sort of teen adventure tone that was very indicative of, like you say, the late 80s and 90s. So it's not representative of my childhood, but it's representative of the stories that I engage with as a child. And also I just love that adventurous tone. I think that's something that, much as I agree with you that that can be problematic because... it's sort of appropriated, and it's also just a thing that studios are doing now as a shorthand for, oh, just make it nostalgic and people will love it because the world is shit now. But for me, like, I think it just brings so much needed levity that horror films have been lacking for a long time, with the exception of, you know, like a few people like horror comedies or Edgar Wright or a couple of other examples that I won't name because I refuse. But, you know, like, they're just missing that sense of joy and that sense of fun that I think then adds to the sense of fear that you feel in those other scenes because you now care about these characters, which is maybe not as much the case for you, Eliza, in this one.
I've been trying to figure out why I have such strong reactions to films like this and the reasons why. And I think I've kind of figured out the things about it that I didn't like that can be applied to other films that I don't like.
Okay.
I struggle with films that have a fantasy character that I can't really explain logically in my mind. It's not scary for me because it's so out of any frame of reference. Like, it would never happen. It's so fantastical. It just wouldn't happen.
That's kind of interesting because, like, I sort of sit in that realm of feeling like the unknown and the unexplained are the most terrifying things. And I acknowledge as well that that can be an issue if a filmmaker's just using that as shorthand for not having rules for their, you know, their creations.
That brings me on to the next point. Yeah, rules. Cool. Rules are so important for me. And it doesn't really, like, Pennywise doesn't have any, like, many rules in terms of, I mean, I guess that's what can make him scary, but for me, that doesn't really make it scary. The fact that there's no way for them to really counteract him, like they can't do anything to him to hurt him, and he's just scary, and they've got no defense against him, which I guess is what some people would find scary, but for me, it just seems like, it's just like, why don't you have something that you can do?
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I think that did take away from the ending a little bit.
You're looking for a secret, but you won't find it. Because, of course, you're not really looking. You don't really want to know. You want to be fooled.
So when you hear the sound,
run for cover, motherfucker!
Understand how they were beating him?
Yeah.
Like, how was it that them coming together diminished his power, and how were they able to physically hurt him when he is so supernaturally powerful? So, yeah, I get that.
Gonna rewind a little bit there and chuck in a little spoiler warning for the old Endorino.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Dive into that.
Okay, begins to tell this in me, which I...
Okay, tell us about the ending.
I just did.
Yeah, but, you've just heard the spoiler warning now, so, you know, I've done a little bit of my audio magic to, you know, to cover your fuck up. So
can't you then just cut in what I already said after the spoiler?
Just cut
warning?
It in, Dave.
Because it was off the cuff. Like, it'd be scripted now.
But how am I going to cut in this funny I just did? This good.
Just like this.
Okay.
Just put it just in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah. Goof break.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
I know that a lot of people had issues with the sort of ending showdown I guess you could phrase it.
I don't understand the ending. I don't know what happened there. By that stage, I was like, come on, finish, end, be over now. It's so close. I can feel it. I can taste it, but it's not there.
I should actually tell you the only, like, I felt compelled along the length of the movie, but the reason that the length did bother me, and I think the reason that it added a lot to the sensation of shock that I felt from the various different scares, was that I made the mistake of having a large beverage in this particular event. And from about maybe the halfway point, I thought I was about to. And nearly every single jump scare was twice as scary because I was convinced that it was going to happen. My bladder would burst any second, and I would be that guy who pissed himself in Stephen King's It at the end of Newtown.
Oh, shit.
And
no.
That was a very, very genuine pressing fear that I think would have been used against me had a Pennywise-like entity been within my general area.
That's a terrible time for you.
Yeah.
I just,
I'm amazed
right
you enjoyed the
very
film at all.
No, I mean, I think it added to it because, like, I go to these films to, you know, to have a sense of an adrenaline rush, and that just added to that sense of, you know, the danger, like that
panic.
Very, yeah, I had an actual, like, danger level. And I think it also speaks to the quality of the storytelling that, you know, I wasn't so bored by what was going on that I could simply get up and go to the bathroom. Like, I did feel compelled enough to stay and permanently damage my whole downstairs beers.
I don't know why you would have done that.
I could have picked a better film, but I still like this film quite a lot, and I stand by it.
Can I go back and talk about that beginning scene that you mentioned, Dave,
mm-hmm.
that you said had the stamp of Fukunaga?
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene was that was probably the best scene of the film.
Yeah.
Which
what
sounds
in that
bad.
Scene again?
The one where he Georgie chases the boat down the stream and meets Pennywise. It was a great introduction to Pennywise. Bill Skarsgård did a great job, especially in that scene.
Yeah.
It did a really fantastic job of setting up the look and the tone of the film. I actually got excited to see the film because I'd seen that.
But it didn't see the end of the scene.
Sorry, no, we didn't see the end of the scene.
Yeah,
but they showed an extended trailer at the beginning of some other film I saw, and I was like, that is cool. I'm going to see that film.
I wish that I hadn't seen that because that would have been so much more impactful if I hadn't just seen it at the movie. I saw that too before Annabelle.
Yeah,
right.
That's also where I saw it.
Mm.
Just FYI as well, we're talking about Bill Skarsgård here, and I mentioned that he doesn't have an enormous amount of credits to his name. He's a Swedish actor, and a lot of the more recent stuff he's done, he appeared in Atomic Blonde and one of the Divergent movies and Victoria and a couple of other things. I think he's in Hemlock Grove, the Netflix series as well.
Which is meant to be awful.
Yeah, so I've heard. And I'm not surprised at all because I believe that's an Eli Roth joint. And if I had a bag of dicks to swing at Eli Roth's head, I would do so in a heartbeat.
I don't know where you get that.
Well, you'd have to harvest them yourself.
Yeah,
harvest
and you have to get
dicks.
Them organic because otherwise it's unethical. It's a difficult process.
Yeah, straight out of the ground.
Organic dicks. Wow. Interesting.
Yep.
I'm glad this is where this conversation is ending up.
Yeah. Eli Roth, bag of dicks.
In the face.
Speaking of Annabelle creation, I could tell the stamp of Gary Dauberman. I assume it was his fault that it had that similar similar pattern to Annabelle creation. Like, it's just a series of builds and then the scare and then the build and then the scare. It had.
Right.
I thought that this film had more to it, but it followed that same structure, and he is credited as a writer on Annabelle creation and Annabelle as well.
Right, and he's a writer on
and
it.
He's
okay,
a writer
cool.
on it, yep.
Right.
Saying that, that just reminds me, every time I think of this film and I try and go through it in my mind, I see each scare as like a chapter on a DVD menu. Like there's so many of them that it's just like you could bookmark every single one and then that would be the whole film.
But at least it had those cool, it had interludes where they were at the pool or...
Yeah, I didn't care for them.
Yeah, right. What I did find weird was, Dave, you're talking about how the appeal of the film to you is it's about the character's psychology and you see all of their fears.
Yeah.
The girl's fear was like torrents of blood, and she had this horrible relationship with an abusive father.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the boys' fears was like, except for
clowns.
Yeah, it was clowns and leprosy and all this kind of weird irrational stuff, except for the young man who saw his parents die in a fire, obviously.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting.
An interesting choice to have this super serious real world fear on behalf of the girl, who was always presented as being a bit more mature than the boys. And all the boys had like, yeah, fear of this mummy with leprosy on its face and weird stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the things that compelled me about it was the fact that while you've got, you know, this inexplicable supernatural entity that fucking murders children every 27 years, like, the really terrifying monsters in the film were the fucking parents. Like, the kid whose mother has Munchausen syndrome and is convincing him he's sick for most of his life. Or the father who's like, it's implied that he's sexually abusing his daughter, very heavily that he's sexually abusing his daughter. And so I think that the blood and the hair have a lot of, you know, they speak to like menstruation and puberty and a lot of those things that one who's suffered childhood abuse would presumably be terrified of. So I think, and again, that speaks back to that opening scene and Georgie getting his arm ripped off, is that those very real things cut in and attack at the otherwise innocent tone of the teen adventure. And that I find interesting and compelling. And so having those adult monsters, I thought, enriched Derry and the general danger that the kids found themselves in. I thought the bully characters were a little bit ridiculous.
Oh, they were so ridiculous. Do you think that So all of the fears that the kids had were pretty much based off something from their parents. Like, all of the children had bad times because of their parents.
Yeah.
Remind me.
So the bully had a really aggressive dad.
Yep.
The girl had the abusive father.
Yep.
The hypochondriac one had extremely, like, overbearing, controlling mum.
Gazebos. Yeah. That was funny. I did like that.
That was all right. What are the other ones? The fat kid?
Rude.
His was...
What was his fear?
His mystery kid, right? Headlessness?
Yeah. But he's kind of just seemed like he didn't really have much of a strong family bond at all.
That's what I mean. Like, so yeah. I think you're right on the ones we did learn enough about.
And the Jewish one, he had the pressure from his father to do his...
Oh, that's what... I didn't make that connection.
Yeah.
I just got the flute monster as a terrifying thing.
Man, I was so gutted that Beverly didn't end up with Ben, is it? The new kid?
The guy who wrote the poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
It was so lovely. Just
it was beautiful.
Kiss Ben, he's so nice.
Yeah.
Of course she wouldn't. That's not real life.
Yeah, but also guess what I have heard about the book, though, and this does make me interested in seeing what book readers' responses would have been to this film. That
Spoiler
scene
for us.
That happens
yeah,
in the
I've
forest.
I've definitely heard this business.
Yes,
so I haven't. Tell
okay,
me.
Okay, so that scene that happens in the forest at the end, when they all agree to return in 27 years and they cement their bond as friends and their pledge to fight this thing wherever it shows up, is cemented by them cutting their hands and making a blood oath, right?
Yeah.
Which I thought was, you know, done pretty well. It doesn't happen like that in the book. What do you think happens, Eliza?
Oh, no, please just tell me.
If you thought
orgy,
you'd be correct.
Orgy? Are they teenagers?
Yes.
Aren't
between
they like
the ages of 13? 13 and 15.
What do you mean, orgy? No, it doesn't.
I mean orgy.
No way.
Yep.
No.
Yep. I'm going to go right now.
Can you find
Wikipedia
that scene?
The Wikipedia page for It, and I am for Stephen King's It, and I am going to find that. And I'm going to be amazed if there's not also a category for controversy based on the 1986 novel.
I'm Googling Stephen King It Orgy.
Also, apparently in the book, Georgie wasn't dragged into the gutter. His arm was just ripped off and he was left there. So he was dead from the beginning, right. And he was known to be dead, like his body was found. So I think that's one intentional thing that they changed to give the sense that waiting to grieve be a part of Bill's experience throughout the film. And I do think that was a clever change.
Yeah, me too. I think that was quite good.
Here we go. Blah, blah, blah. Bill enters the monster's mind through the ritual of Chud, thank you Stephen King, and discovers that its true form is a mass of destructive orange lights, which it refers to as the Deadlights. Mm-hmm. With the help of Maturin, which from reference, I watched a YouTube video about this.
Yeah,
Maturin
I did
is
too.
A giant turtle. A giant cosmic turtle.
Yeah.
Bill is able to defeat it and send it back to its slumber. After the battle, the losers, which is the name of the group of kids, get lost in the sewers until Beverly has sex with all the boys to bring unity back to the group.
Yeah, apparently that they get lost in the sewers and Bev tells them that the only way for them to get out is to have sex.
Is to get they fuck on.
That's weird.
Probo. That's
what follows is an extended description of Beverly encouraging and having sex with each of the boys.
It is
technically, here I'm quoting here, it is technically speaking a gangbang featuring children.
That is horrifying.
That's super, super fucked up.
I mean, look, none of us have read the book. We don't know how it's handled in the book to give him some benefit of the doubt. But also it seems like a strange choice to make.
The notion of people underage having consensual sex with each other is, like, you know, not the most shocking thing in the world, but an orgy between one girl and six boys who are all underage, that's a fucking hot mess.
I have a statement from Stephen King about that.
All right.
I wasn't really thinking of the sexual aspect of it. The book dealt with childhood and adulthood. The grown-ups don't remember their childhood. None of us remember what we did as children. We think we do, but we don't remember it as it really happened. Intuitively, the losers knew that they had to be together again. The sexual act connected childhood and adulthood. It's another version of the glass tunnel that connects the children's library and the adult library. Times have changed since I wrote that scene, and there is now more sensitivity to those issues.
Okay, mate, I don't remember everything that I did in my childhood, but I certainly don't remember the point that me and five of my mates had sex with the same girl in a sewer.
That is a weird scene.
Dude, especially because, like, so much of the early part of it is these boys becoming friends with Beverly, who is isolated because people make rumors about her being a slut, which is horrible. To then have her have consensual sex with the whole group is just
hang on.
Weird. I can see what's happening. I wish that video was a part of this. Eliza is being lick attacked by Toby furiously.
Who is a giant dog, if we haven't mentioned that
it's
before?
Just the largest dog. He's guested on the podcast before, Joe. He's a...
Well, this might be the listener's first time.
Familiar guest
spot. Oh, sorry. He just licked my open mouth.
I can hear his tongue in the microphone. That's super great.
Why
Joe,
do you
can
love
you,
me?
Can you resolve this issue?
Oh, yeah, he'll calm down. Just push him off you.
All right, get down. Get down. Get down. Go down. Get down.
He's proving his greatest strength to Eliza. All right, there he is.
All right. Okay.
All right, well, do we have any closing statements on it? Why should people who don't like to be spooked see this movie?
Because everyone else is. Get on that bandwagon.
Yeah, you gotta be cool. You better be cool. See the blockbuster. Talk the talk.
Such cynicism.
It's true though, right?
Well, yeah, but that's not the only reason.
There was that one good scene in the house where they opened the door and the door said, scary, not scary. You know that.
That was good.
That was the one bit that I enjoyed.
It's hard because this film, like, it's the fun is in the scares. It's one of those films. If you don't like jump scares, then you probably won't have a great time.
Yeah.
But if you do, it's a really solid, fun adventure film that has kind of more weight and depth than something like Annabelle Creation.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, speaking of Annabelle Creation and speaking of that tonal thing that I was talking about before, you know what it does remind me of really strongly, which I watched earlier this week? And I'm not putting it on the same plane as this film because I think this film is an absolute goddamn masterpiece, but tonally, it's very similar to Poltergeist. It's got that same sort of family adventure kind of vibe. interspersed with genuinely shocking, genuinely scary moments. And that is a tone that I love. And so in aspiring to that, I think it gets a couple of extra points for me, if not being the perfect execution of it. So I'm going to give it a solid 3.5 fond childhood orgies.
No, no, that's not okay. Oh.
Stay sticking to it. I'll give it also 3.5. I'll give it 3.5 waxed paper racing boats out of 5.
That's pretty nice.
That's a nice, calm comparison.
I'm going to give it 1.5 underwhelming jump scares out of 5.
Oof.
That's harsh. Oof.
Man, more like shit, am I right?
Ah, good one!
Man, whoever wrote this was a clown.
Oh, no!
I think that's the bottom of the barrel. I think we finally reached it.
Deep into it.
Yeah.
Listener, if you're brand new, we don't get better than this.
Sorry, I just ruined what you were saying. Can I have a toilet break, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Joe.
Yes, Dave.
You have 5 possible stars. How many do you give Eliza?
No, that's mean. She'll hear, she'll listen back.
Oh no, what are you saying about me?
Wait, can only virgins see this stuff? Is that why I'm not seeing this shit?
Moving right along from our super, super dated film review from the cinema, let's get on to something a little less fresh. This is a movie from last year, and it is the final flick in our zombie thread. Thanks to Eliza for the pick. This one is Train to Busan. Siokwu's workaholism has meant success in business, but it's also estranged him from his ex-wife and his 8-year-old daughter, Su-an. When he can't make the time to spend Su-an's birthday with her, Su-an demands to take the train back home to Busan, and Siokwu reluctantly agrees. Which is good, because otherwise she would have been alone on the train when a viral outbreak brings the zombie apocalypse crashing down on South Korea. So this movie kind of made huge waves internationally on release. Korean cinema has for a while been a huge international success, but specifically when it comes to horror movies or action movies, pretty much everyone now is familiar with Old Boy. It also launched the careers of people like Bong Joon-ho, who made The Host and Okja and Snowpiercer. There's all sorts of like classic Korean revenge films and horror films that are available now, which is great. And they all are identified by a certain hardness. There's something sort of identifiably Korean about the uncompromising way that directors from the country approach these kind of stories. So Train to Busan is very full on, pretty much from the word go. And I'm going to throw to Joe first on this one. What were your thoughts on Train to Busan?
I thought it was great. Well, okay, great is a superlative. I thought it was very good.
I thought it was quite excellent.
Wait, no, it was okay. It was fine. No, I hated it. It was terrible.
Oh, no, what a rollercoaster ride of emotions.
No, it was good. I kind of had to get past the sickening sentiment of much of it, which I know is weird for a zombie film. But the kind of soft piano, slow motion, like touching father-daughter stuff is something I had to get past. It's just not something that naturally resonates with me as anything but artificial and manufactured, which I know the whole thing is because it's a film.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
Yeah, that's it. This is actually not a documentary, surprisingly enough. Fortunately, yeah. South Korea seems to be doing okay. Not as many undead.
But that's just a minor note. Otherwise, it was really fun. I thought the zombies were compelling, which is quite difficult to do now that we've had so many iterations of them. I thought the setting was very inspired. The train worked really well. Yeah, pretty solid.
Cool. I'm actually really glad that you brought up the sentiment of it, because I think that's something well worth pointing out to specifically Western audiences seeing this movie for the first time. If you haven't seen a great deal of Asian cinema, or even quite specifically Asian television, then that's something that you just would not be used to. But that sort of soft piano, hyper-sentimentalized emotional drama and almost melodrama is totally the norm to the majority of Asian media. You've either got, like, you know, super, super stripped back minimalism like you would have with 1950s Japanese filmmaking, or you have overwhelmingly, like, heavily soundtrack-laden motions of heart-swelling, you know, music. It's all about laboring that thing. It's all about people clinging to each other and just being like, no, Johnny, don't, please don't sacrifice yourself for me. You know, it's the sort of thing that you see if you've watched any anime series for more than three episodes. You're very, very used to this soft piano, no, please, kind of thing going on. I love you more than breathing. You know, that sort of, like, intensity to the emotions, I think, is very iconic of Asian drama. And I do say that in the broad sense, because that's something that I've seen in Chinese cinema. It's something that I've seen in Japanese cinema, definitely in Korean cinema, obviously in this. It was absolutely overwhelming watching TV in the Philippines, because there was, like, there was no moment in their soap operas where there was not some sort of, like, soft piano swell going on and people, you know, rapidly turning around with their hair swings going, tell me the truth! It was always that level of heightened emotion.
But that's soap opera anyway, right? That's
yeah,
that genre.
It's totally soap opera, but I think even comparing, like, the soap opera that I saw in the Philippines to something like Days of Our Lives, it was even more soapy. It was heightened so much more. And I think that's just partly because, you know, there is so much media and so many voices going on in a lot of countries where this kind of media is made, that you kind of just have to be big in order to break through. And it's also because there's a different attitude towards politeness in your, well, this is true of Japanese anyway. There's a different sort of mode of politeness and a way of relating to people that you have, and all sorts of, you know, ways, coded ways of socializing that are quite carefully coded. And so you sort of go by those in your way of life. And so when it comes to your media, where you're just enjoying sort of, you know, ridiculous emotions, this is why these things can be so extreme. This is why Japanese horror tends to really push boundaries. This is why Japanese metal bands tend to be, like, you know, completely overwhelming to people who've never heard them before, and quite shocking. And I think it's the same reason that you have that same sort of knee-jerk reaction to the big swells of sentiment that happen in Train to Busan, is because it's something that you're not culturally adapted to, I guess. It's something that's not been a part of your life since childhood. So
yeah, possibly.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point of difference. And it's something that, yeah, I sort of had to, you know, maybe bite my bottom lip a little bit and go, like, don't laugh. This is a very serious moment. But I managed to get past that just because the emotion of the actors, I think, sort of sold it. And everything else in the film was so heightened, I just had to sort of let it coexist in the same role. Eliza, what do you think of Train to Busan?
This is my idea of a fun movie.
Yeah, right?
Hooray! I don't hate everything. I fucking love this film. It's so great. I think that the piano bits, they are a bit jarring at first. But I think once you can push past it, and it didn't take me very long to push past it, it makes sense in terms of what you were saying, Dave, in terms of everything else is so heightened, so it just makes sense that that is too.
yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, and of course you're going to feel these big, crazy emotions when you're in the middle of, like, this insane situation. Like, I sort of hate this implication that, you know, everyone would kind of just be muted and worn out and, you know, desensitized by all of the violence and everything going on. Like that makes sense in something like The Walking Dead, where it's ongoing and you're dealing with that situation over long periods of time, and people become, you know, sort of like crushed by it or desensitized to it. But in the case of Train to Busan, it's all happening and it's all immediate, and so all of those emotions are just they're all ongoing simultaneously, and so I think that brings a wonderful sense of panic to the entirety of the film.
I didn't feel like the emotions were too big or overacted. It was more, and in one particular scene, which we shan't discuss. Yeah, it was the construction of it. Like, yeah, the combination of the acting and the soft. It was mostly the soft piano music, if I'm honest with you. It was, to me, and it might be this cultural thing, but to me it was just like the most obvious heavy-handed way of doing feelings.
Yeah. You can feel the strings tugging your emotions. You're like, just leave me alone.
It's like they're not coaxing your heartstrings into movement. They just kind of push forcefully into your chest and grab them and jiggle them around.
Yeah.
But that being said, it wasn't ineffectual once I let it happen.
Yeah. You just got to let it happen.
Yeah. I know the moment you're talking about. I'm excited to talk about that in spoiler territory.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let's just talk a bit more broadly about Train to Busan first. To give you a couple of reference points here as well, I mean, it was a really highly critically acclaimed film. Some of the things that I thought worth bringing up about the critical response to it, though, someone said that Clark Collis from Entertainment Weekly said that it borrows heavily from World War Z in its depiction of the fast-moving undead masses, while also boasting an emotional core the Brad Pitt starring extravaganza often lacked, and that they love it. And in contrast, Edgar Wright said it was the best zombie movie I've seen in forever, which I would have to agree with. And I think that's also partly due to the fact that it's like it's such an overwhelmingly sodden genre at the moment. But one of the negative reviews described the film as Snowpiercer with zombies, and I do not understand how that's a negative.
That's not negative at all.
Snowpiercer's dope. These zombies are cool. This is Snowpiercer with zombies and it fucking rocks.
I do enjoy, I think reasons I enjoyed it is there is a clear set of rules. Because I normally don't like running zombies, but because there were rules that helped to control the zombies, I really enjoy that.
Yeah, and those rules were things that I don't think I've seen in recent zombie movies as well. They were genuinely inventive and led to action sequences that were tense as fuck. Like, my God, was I on the edge of my seat for, like, 80% of this film. It really captivated me in that way. Yeah, I love the whole idea that they can't see in the dark. Man, Jesus, like, they made use of the geography of that train so effectively. It's so convincing. I mean, there's a short sequence of World War Z, which I believe we're all agreed is an absolute garbage fire of a film.
I've not watched it because I have assumed that that was the case. Yeah.
Don't ever need to. I'm told that the book it's based on is absolute genius, that the podcast adaptation of it, which has like Alfred Molina and a bunch of other incredible actors involved with it, is really, really, really top notch. But the movie is a garbage fire. But there's a short sequence of that occurs on a plane that just has none of the fear factor that
that said it all, really.
Yeah, it has none of the fear factor that any 5 seconds of this movie have. It's just so compelling. And one of the other critics talked about the film's subtle class warfare, and I would like to say to that reviewer, how subtle is a meat cleaver to the face? I think this film's discussion of class is like absolutely front and center.
Yeah.
It's so crucial to the construction of the film. And I was saying to Joe before Eliza while you were taking a break that I think another discussion that will happen among a lot of Western viewers is the exploration of gender in this film as well. I think that's something that our perception is quite colored by in regards to the film. And it's a conversation that I think is going to be interesting to keep tonally balanced. But let's maybe dive into that, the sort of deeper meaning of Train to Busan. Where did it all go for you?
In what sense? What are the makers?
Besides a fucking rad zombie action movie, what did the makers of Train to Busan have to say?
This sounds like we're writing an essay.
It was a cool zombie film.
Zombies
on a train! Yeah.
But that's like, this is what this podcast allows us to do, I think. It allows us to simultaneously engage in academia about films that some people find too confronting, and it also allows us to go, zombie action sequences and trains are fucking lit, and that's what I enjoy about this form, you know?
Yeah, I think if we're talking about the intentions of the makers, I didn't spot any obvious signposts that they were trying to say anything. I think class was a very easy way for them to have good guys and bad guys. Mm. And I think I didn't even think of the gender roles, to be honest. I watched it on its own level, which was a cool, inventive, effective zombie film. Not to say that there's not more to read in there, but I don't think that they had a wider point.
For me, it was more about the exploration of fatherhood, which I feel like that was the real focus of this entire film. I mean, you know, go back to Hitchcock, like the train is a phallic symbol for one thing, but secondly, and more, you know, more blatantly, I would say the whole film, you know, the reason that they're on the train is because the girl wants to go back to her mother because her father sucks, because her father's bad and engaging with her. That's the reason that they're in this situation. But the father, you know, the father has this responsibility to protect her. The as Wikipedia describes him, tough, surly, working class husband, Sang Hua. You know, he's not at all, I think, I don't think he's a toxic man, but he's definitely more abrupt and brusque and, you know, better fitted to, I guess, that classic idea of masculinity. He's a big guy. He's, you know, willing to kick off with people if they, you know, look at him the wrong way. And he's super protective and a little bit possessive of his pregnant wife, as you would sort of expect a protective husband to be. And so, like, it's interesting watching, you know, the development of Seok-woo as a father figure. And the line that really sort of struck home as being the most core thing to the entirety of the film is when Sung-hwa tells Seok-woo that, you know, the fatherhood is about making sacrifices and about no one, you know, fully appreciating those sacrifices. You're not going to get a pat on the back. You're not going to get a medal for it. But a father makes sacrifices.
Which fits in with the typical traditional notions of masculinity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see Western audiences sort of taking that in because, you know, it's not necessarily an idea that provides the female characters in this film a lot of agency. And I don't think the female characters in this film have an awful lot.
But they also don't just stand back and do nothing. They do also do a lot in terms of, like, actually physically fighting the zombies. They don't just stand there and just be onlookers and let the men handle everything, which I thought was good. And, yeah, I was actively thinking about that as I was watching it.
Yeah, cool.
What was very well done, and look, I'll be honest with the two of you, I've just thought of this, but you can cut this bit out and pretend that we are really prepared and think deeply about these films before we talk about them.
Oh, that's staying.
That was your mistake, Joe.
Yeah. I can't
share my
process.
Barreled in.
Speaking of class and those two characters, the rich CEO and then the working class hero, those were the two extremes towards which Seok-woo could have gone. He's a man who's in the middle of it. He's a father. He's an underling. He's got a lot of pressure at work. He's not the boss, but he is the boss of some people.
Mm-hmm.
And he also does very well financially. And then those two characters represent the two extremes. You've got this callous, selfish CEO, and then you've got the working class husband, Sang-hwa, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back to what you said previously, Dave, about how he's a bit of a macho guy. He's actually, they make a point that he's very tender and caring towards his wife and actually submits to her.
Yeah.
The first time we see him, he's outside the toilet door and he knocks tenderly and gently and says, are you all right in there? And she yells at him or bangs on the door or something and he backs right down.
Yeah.
And that's the way that Seok-woo ends up going.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the victory. And maybe we won't get into spoiler territory yet, but that's his realization as a character.
Yeah, and I think you can talk about a character arc without necessarily, you know, spoiling a film. I think that's totally fine. I think that's very much the focal point for him. And don't get me wrong as well, like, I think, you know, I think Sung-hwa is, like, a fucking great character. Like, he carries a lot of the film on his shoulders. I mean, he's so compelling to watch. I also just particularly love his conversations with the 8-year-old Su-an, where, you know, the like, she's feeling the belly of Song-kyung, the pregnant woman, and he just sort of, like, points and he's like, I made that. And his wife, like, slaps him. And, like, he brings a lot of life and levity to it. Again, something that a film that goes to the bleak fucking places that this does desperately needs. And that's what salvages it and makes it such a compelling flick. Did we want to dive into spoilers then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's kill it. Let's fucking kill it.
What did you just say?
There's a bit of death.
Was that just the fire of hell, like,
yeah,
that came out of your mouth?
It just pops up from time to time.
Okay, all right, yeah. That's fine. You're excused.
Thank you. How do we want to kick this off? Everybody dies the end. That's not true.
I just want to point out that was Eliza literally saying, I want to talk, and Dave interrupting her.
To be fair, she interrupted my song.
True, true.
I spoke at the time when I thought you were going to stop singing.
No, you can't ever expect
I know.
That.
It was too much. I want to talk about Yeon-suk.
Yes,
the bad,
tell me about Yeon-suk.
Bad rich guy. I think that the fear that he created in the other train passengers was just done so beautifully. He just turned all of them against them, and it was just all based on fear, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Have you seen The Mist?
Years ago, and I hated it.
Okay.
But I can't remember why.
Because I thought that was one of the compelling things about The Mist as well, is that there was a woman who was like a religious zealot who just, you know, kind of seemed a bit batshit to begin with, but she started to talk everyone in the room around and, you know, drove them into that same sort of fear-based frenzy. And again, that, you know, was the most compelling part of that movie. So I feel like that's something that potentially may have even been inspired by Stephen King coming into this. Not that, you know, it's not something that an independent Korean filmmaker couldn't have come up with on their own terms, but coming from a Western perspective, I'd just be like, yeah, cool. There's a bit of that Stephen King flavor rolling around in this big old bibimbap dish. It's a what? Korean food reference bibimbap. There.
Oh, right.
Num, num, num.
Delicious.
Bit of culture for you, Joe. Bit of culture.
thank you, Dave, first of all. Can we talk about that the soft piano scene now?
Why do you want to talk
about
soft piano?
Because it brings together a lot of the points that I've been making. One, that is the scene, so for the listener to keep up, this is the scene which is roughly near the end of the film. It's the proper climax to the film where Seok-woo realizes he's been bitten and throws himself off the back of the train.
Yeah.
That was the scene that was a bit much for me in terms of the sentiment, the soft piano. In my brain, it's happening in slow motion. I don't know if that is
the silhouette
thing.
Of him falling off the train is in slow mo. Yeah.
Right. And it's also, it was a frustrating scene because it's kind of a sad ending. I felt robbed in a good way. Like, it was a really well done by the filmmaker. But then reflecting, you know, he had his victory in that he redeemed himself by choosing to be a good father
he
in
made
the end.
The ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what a father do.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of, that's the scene that stands out as it should because it's the climax to the film. But then also the choice to have them walk through the tunnel and the tension of whether they were going to get popped in the head or not was also really good.
I was terrified. I was so 100% convinced that we were going to get the Night of the Living Dead outcome. And I was just living
which would have
in
made
fear.
Absolute sense because of the genre and because we'd just seen Seok-woo go down when he was the main protagonist.
Yeah. And again, that beautiful callback to the fact that she couldn't sing the rest of the song because she'd learned it specifically for him. And she couldn't sing it at the recital because he wasn't there. But at this moment when he's not there, he's with her because, you know, he's redeemed himself. He's made that sacrifice for her. And so he walks with her. And that was, beautiful. And it gave a lot of weight to that ending.
I can tell you about my all-time favorite bit in the entire movie. Oh my god, it's something so small. It's kind of like, it's not a plot hole thing, but it's just something dumb.
But anyway, I'll play the stinger anyway.
So, you know, in the train conductor, he's like my favorite character in the whole movie, even though he doesn't really do that much. You know the train conductor, how
Which
he gets
train conductor
the one that gets out of the train when they arrive at Busan and tries to find another. Well, is that Busan or they're almost at Busan? And he gets out of the train and tries to find another train to take them there.
Yeah, it's almost at Busan. Yeah,
he was a hero.
Okay, he was a hero.
He was a great character, and the funniest thing happens where he opens the door of a carriage and there's a zombie in there. And I don't know if it's just like lost in translation, like the subtitles weren't very good, but his reaction when he opens the door is just, oh no. That's what the subtitle reads. Just, oh no. That is my
Well, I guess you
haven't
seen
thing.
That map just like in the way of the zombies across the rest of the film. So it was just sort of like, oh no.
But it wasn't even like a giant reaction. There wasn't even an exclamation mark at the end of the subtitle. It was just a full stop. So it was literally, oh no.
Oh gracious.
What have I done?
When something happens, something major in your life, and just that little, just what a champ.
Jeezy Pete. You know?
That'd be a good gift to have. I'd like that gift.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, such a ledge.
Make that your mission, Eliza. That is the brand new, fresh, hot, nothing to fear gift. He'll just be like, oh no.
Just kind of underwhelmed, disappointed, semi-terror.
I thought I'd be more scared than this. Will nothing break through the drudgery of the everyday? Yeah, he was a hero, which I guess brings us back to Yuk-sun, who I think I just pronounced his name incorrectly.
Are you talking about
Yeon-suk, the bad rich guy?
Oh, man, I did it so bad. Yeon-suk. I think the machinations of his particular evil towards the end of the film were just horrifying. I mean, there's that really gut-wrenching scene with the two teenagers, like that really struck home. But also, so like, I loved as well the final actions of the elderly sister Jeong-gil. I thought she was super great. I thought it was quite a compelling display of elderly characters as well. I don't think I'd seen a lot of elderly characters in zombie movies who hit home in that way. I think a lot of the time elderly characters don't tend to feature in these kind of films because they can't run fast enough. So there's sort of the assumption that they wouldn't have made it to the point where they can have developed character arcs.
True.
Yeah. I just thought that was really great characterization.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That I engaged with all of the characters, like no matter how small they were, they all had a really distinct set of personality traits. That even in those little glimpses, you could get a sense of who they were and what they were doing. Like, that's beautiful in a film. Normally you just have these, especially in a zombie film, you just have these characters that you don't, well, I find, don't really connect with, or they're just terrible for the sake of being terrible because you need someone that's an antagonist to the plot, you know? But yeah, I don't know. They were just so great.
I really liked the softball baseball team.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had some heartbreaking moments. They had some really, like, brutal moments with that whole ensemble. I think there's also something to say about the character of the undead in this film, because there's something so specifically shocking to the realization of them here. The way that they sort of turn with that kind of electrical shock convulsion, and they're all, you know, all of their stunt doubles who are doing the moments of transformation are clearly like gymnasts who are doing bodily contortions that should not be physically possible, which are just absolutely mortifying to watch. And that definitely brought something to it that separated it from something like Dawn of the Dead, which just had them, you know, running. Essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the quick turnaround from being bitten to turning.
Yeah. Mm. Which that, brings which brings Go me on. To Dave's closing monologue, which I kind of was thinking about something that I wanted to say about Dawn of the Dead last time around that I didn't get to say because I thought about it afterwards. But I was having this conversation with Joe and we were talking about how we kind of changed our feelings about the movie since the first time that we'd seen it. No, particularly me, because I thought quite highly of it when I was a teenager. Mm. But looking at it now, like, I mean, it's a very bleak film, and I have nothing against bleak apocalypse cinema, because, you know, that's all well and good, and I understand a certain urge towards nihilism. But we'd also talked with Dawn of the Dead about commercialization and how the original film was about commercialization, whereas the second film was kind of just a cash-in on that activist notion and that pushing back against that system. One of the things that I didn't get a chance to talk about when, Eliza, you prompted me to talk about that whole thing with violence against zombies as being a justified violence against you know, the human body. I think what really struck me about that is that the original Dawn of the Dead had a real sense of purpose to dehumanizing and destroying the human body as graphically as possible. And it was as a way of specifically linking the nature of that violence to the Vietnam War reporting, which was being, you know, transmitted to the US at the time. People were being confronted with the destruction of human bodies in a way that they had never seen before. War had never been televised. At worst, people had seen, you know, maybe sort of Grand Guignol effects, or they'd heard stories, but no one had ever been confronted with violence on this scale. And so what Romero was doing was trying to capture that sense of horror and disgust and the dehumanization that this kind of mass violence brings about. And I think that really, like, resonates through the original Dawn of the Dead. But in the second Dawn of the Dead, it just feels like it's missed the point enormously. Romero's violence is speaking to a nihilism that comes from a place of deep philosophical questioning and pain, and Snyder's just sort of copying that out of a sense of homage and pastiche that says nothing except nihilism, nihilism without purpose. And I think what makes Train to Busan stand out among zombie films is that it is harrowingly bleak, but I don't think it is nihilistic at all. I think there is a resonant humanity to it that comes through in its humor, in the strength of its characters, and in their capacity to endure and make sacrifices that count. I think characters in Dawn of the Dead make sacrifices out of obligation to a script. I think you can see this kind of callousness in the work that Snyder's done with DC as he's gone on. I don't think he places as much value in the lives of his characters as he should. I think a horror filmmaker should be someone who does not wish to create these three-dimensional characters, put them in a box and torture them, but feels a sense of obligation to do so, as it's the only way to communicate the point. It's the only way to get people to listen, is to build people, fictional people that they love, and to tear them apart in front of them. And that process is painful, but it's the only way to get the point across. I think that's something that Snyder doesn't understand. I think that's something that the majority of games that revolve around zombies and killing zombies and violence against other survivors also misses, that central humanist point. That it's not simply about the fact that you and everyone you love is a bag of meat that will eventually die. It's about the endurance of humanity and our ability to get through even the most inexplicable tragedy and to carry on and know ourselves better through that struggle. So that's my thoughts on the zombie genre, I guess.
Well said, Dave.
Yeah, that was really good. I kind of feel like I want to...
A gentle one.
But when you hear the podcast in full, my God, will that be a chorus of applause. That will be the full stadium. There's going to be some work done on that. A bit of ambiance added, I think.
Maybe some swelling string section.
Yes, I'm going to put soft piano under it. It's going to be beautiful.
Oh, my God, that'll be beautiful.
Too perfect.
But it has to fade in really slowly towards the end.
And then drown out the actual end of the speech by just getting really, really loud. Oh, all right. Do we have any final thoughts on Train to Busan or The Shuffling Dead in general?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I've had a great time talking about zombie films. When we started, I thought, okay, we're doing a creature thread. I guess this will be fun, but there's a lot more in zombies, and I think you've just summed it up very well, Dave. Mm. And there's a lot of angles you can come at it from that make it a really interesting and unique genre. Yeah, so I'm glad we did it. I think the films we picked, well done to us, were
yeah,
fairly interesting markers of the genre.
I think the real winners, the real top performers here were the podcasters of Nothing to Fear.
Yep.
And absolutely. The beneficiaries were you, the listener. So thank you, as always, for tuning in.
Yep.
And yeah, thank you, Eliza, for the thread choice. I think it was quite... I was also worried that it's just going to be like, oh, zombies are dull, but I think we, yeah, got a lot of mileage out of it, so... Good
nah, dude, zombies are rad.
Yeah, and also, thank you so fucking much for recommending this movie, because, I loved it. I loved it, I loved it, I loved it. I am giving it 5 duct-taped wrapped arms out of 5.
I'm just staring longingly into Joe's eyes. I give it... Oh, I love this movie. It's so great. I'm going to give it 5 subtly frightened train conductors out of 5.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I'm going to give it 4 salt of the earth working class heroes out of 5.
Nice.
Yes, Sunghwa would be proud. 4, you piece of shit. Yeah. Give it the... Damn it. No. I wonder, has there been a film that we've universally panned or universally given 5 stars?
Night of the Living Dead.
Surely Night of the Living Dead we liked. I think we liked Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Back in the early days of season 1.
Is it time for a clip show yet, guys? Go back and revisit those.
Fuck no. Sorry, I didn't let you finish your sentence.
No, that's all good. As always, yeah, thank you so much for listening in. We're 3 episodes deep into season 2 now, and are yet to actually release episode 1, so we're excited for you to hear all of these fresh takes on films that have long since been out of rotation. Next week, we're going to be looking at Darren Aronofsky's Mother, which I imagine many of you have developed a pretty concrete opinion about by now, but I look forward to challenging that. And moving on to a brand new thread. So if you have a cool idea for what our next thread could be, you can send it in to nothingtofearpod@gmail.com. That's the number 2.
If you don't enjoy using email, because let's face it, it's not as instant as something like Twitter, you can actually follow us on Twitter at nothingtofearpod. Is that right?
Seamless, yeah, seamless.
And we have a Facebook, which just, you know, just type Nothing to Fear with a little letter 2 in. I don't think it needs to have pod. Just Google it. All of our media will come up. We are prolific social media responders, as I think
we're so good at
all
it.
Of our pages will testify.
We're strong influencers.
So hit us up there. Let us know next thread. That would be super exciting. We have some ideas, but anything you pitch our way, we'll also be super excited about.
Yeah. Get in on this brand. Get in on this, you know, hot hashtag content right at the ground level, you know? It's only going up. Please. It can only go up. It has to. Please.
Also, I don't know about, I'm just going to speak on behalf of you guys, but just say hello because I'd like a new friend.
I'm just, yeah.
It's I already have 3 friends.
3?
For all you Seinfeld fans out there.
The one thing that will really help us if you have enjoyed the podcast so far, if you see us in the street, just chuck us a 20 if you've got one on you. Or otherwise, you could hop onto iTunes, like and subscribe and leave us a star rating, because that really helps out with the metrics and it gets us out to a few more people so we can tell them what be good at dem movies. So thank you again. I am David Malloy.
I'm Joe Parrow.
I'm Eliza Sykes.
And until next time, ride safe.